This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
So in honor of having our esteemed North American Director of Education in the room, we're going to start at American time, 7:30 on the dot. Welcome, everyone. My name is Ilana. I work here at Pardes and had the pleasure many, many years ago, 10 years back, of studying with Yaffa in this Beit Midrash. So it gives me tremendous, tremendous honor to welcome Yaffa back. It feels like all is right with the world again to have Yaffa teaching our students here in this Beit Midrash in Jerusalem, where it all started. Yaffa has taught at many, many different institutions. Yaffa Epstein received ordination from Yeshivat Maharat, has taught in a number of other prestigious institutions, for the Wexner Foundation, for the Darod Foundation, for the Drisha Institute, amongst many, many others. But first and foremost, always comes home to Pardes, and we're thrilled to have her here. And Yaffa oversees all of our educational activities in North America, is setting the vision for where Pardes is going in North America. And we're very, very privileged and lucky to have you here tonight and excited to learn Torah with you. So thank you, Yaffa. And this evening tonight is part of a series, the Jay and Huti Pomerantz lecture series. It's been going on for several weeks, and we'll wrap up next week with our final class with Aviva Goldberg. So we hope that we see you all back here next week. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Ilana, for that amazing introduction. Hi, everybody. Ilana's a little taller than me. I have to use the microphone because we're recording this, but you're going to see that I don't really need the microphone, so I'm just going to apologize if this happens to be very loud. If suddenly it's too loud, just go like this, like, help, it's too loud. Also, in case you're bored, there's a gorgeous sunset that's been provided for us, so you can always just look out the window in case this is boring you. So hi, everyone. Good evening. It really is a huge schut. It's a huge merit to be back in the Pardes Beit Midrash and to be able to teach Torah again in Yerushalayim. Tonight's class is called Achieving Work-Life Balance, A Struggle as Old as the Talmud. And I feel like I need to like make a confession as I start a session like this, because, hi. Many people have said to me, like, Yaffa, like, you're so not the person on this earth to give a class on work-life balance. In fact, I was preparing part of this source sheet last night at 12:30 a.m., and I put it on Facebook. I said, like, oh, it's so ironic, I'm preparing a shiur, a session on work-life balance at 12:30 a.m., and I got, listen to this, my friends, 220 likes. Those of you who are Facebook people, I'm a big Facebook person, much to my chagrin. And I got 220 likes at that hour of the morning. And I thought that it was sort of appropriate, because what that told me was that most of us can relate. Most of us can relate to sending an email for work at 12:30 in the morning. The world that we live in today is so full and so busy. Not that way, I'm not this one. And so busy, and so full of our work and our obligations, right? This question, it's not this. Nobody has it. Come on in. Nobody has text yet. It's okay. Come back to me, my friends. Okay, so we live in a very, very crazy, busy world, and as technology advances, our work-life balance, I would say, evaporates. And it's very interesting, actually, because this is actually something that the whole world has been talking about. This question of, can I have it all? Can I do it all? Right? Is it possible in the world that we live in to have it all? And there's sort of this goal and this idea that it is actually possible. If I just finish all my emails, everything will be right in the world. I don't know if anybody relates to that, but I think it's a very sort of interesting question. Fascinatingly, I would say, the rabbis of the Talmud were struggling with it as well. So if we think it's a new phenomenon because we have iPhones and Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it's not. Even before the invention of the World Wide Web, the question of work-life balance was one that was facing the world. And the question I have is, why? What is it about this feeling that I'm always pulled in a million directions that is age old? Okay, that's sort of the question that we're going to be asking. And to kick us off, I wanted to start with this piece. Now I'm going to hand out the text, okay? I don't know if there's going to be For now, we'll share. So take one for two. Oh, here, I have an extra one. Okay. For now, we'll share one for two, and then eventually we'll have more, okay? But this was a TED Talk. TED Talk, what's a TED Talk? Friends? Yeah, 20 or 10, between 10 and 20 minute speech talk, right, about a specific topic, someone who is supposedly an expert on that issue. And this is a quote from a TED Talk by Anne Marie Slaughter, who wrote an incredibly controversial article saying, in 2012, saying that it is not possible for women to have it all. Specifically, the issue of can we have it all was seen as a feminist question, okay? And she says very clearly, she's Princeton educated, and she was a very important public policy scholar for the United States government. She says there very clearly that it is actually not possible for women to have it all. And then in 2013, she gave a TED Talk on why she thinks it's not possible, not just for women not to have it all, but in fact for anyone to have it all. It's actually not a possible thing, okay? So I wanted to start with this to see if we feel that Anne Marie Slaughter is close to the Talmud or far away from the Talmud, okay? Has anything changed between the year 200 and the year 2013, okay? That's sort of the question that we have. So can I have a volunteer from the audience to read, please, this piece by Anne Marie Slaughter? Who's reading for us? Be brave. Yes, go ahead.
So, my moment of truth did not come all at once. In 2010, I had the chance to be considered for promotion. Performed my job as director of policy planning at the U.S. State Department. This was my moment to lean in, to push myself forward for what are really only a handful of the very top foreign policy jobs. And I just finished a big 18-month project for Secretary Clinton successfully, and I knew I could handle a bigger job. The woman I thought I was would have said yes. But I had been commuting for 2 years between Washington and Princeton, New Jersey, where my husband and my two teenage sons lived, and it was not going well. I tried on the idea of eking out another 2 years in Washington, or maybe uprooting my sons from their school and my husband from his work and asking them to join me. But deep down, I knew that the right decision was to go home, even if I didn't fully recognize the woman who was making that choice. That was a decision based on love and responsibility. I couldn't keep watching my oldest son make bad choices without being able to be there for him when and if he needed me. But the real change came more gradually.
Okay, I'm going to pause you right there, and I'm going to ask you, I'm going to just tell you what she says in the next couple paragraphs, which is basically that she realizes that she doesn't want to go back to her job. Even if she could, she doesn't want to, after she takes off this time. And then she goes on to say that actually, it's not just a female issue, okay? So let's just skip down to three lines up from the second to last paragraph. I suggest that real equality. You there?
Right.
To three lines up, the middle of the line, the second to last paragraph.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, great.
But that's only half of real equality. And I now think we're never going to get there unless we recognize the other half. I suggest that real equality, full equality, does not just mean valuing women on male terms. It means creating a much wider range of equally respected choices for women and for men. And to get there, we have to change our workplaces, our policies, and our culture. In the workplace, real equality means valuing family just as much as work, and understanding that the two reinforce each other.
Okay, we're going to pause right there. Okay, so I want to ask you guys, what do you think about that sentence? Equality, real equality means valuing family just as much as work and understanding that the two reinforce each other. What do we think about that? Agree, disagree, yes, just tell me your name, I'm sorry.
Brenda. But your boss is not paying you to value your family time, he's paying for your hours to be at work.
Okay, great. So part of the problem, when I hear you saying Brenda, is it's a great idea to say that of course we value work and family equally, but the reality of the workplace is that we have, right, our supervisors who are demanding, and they're not really interested necessarily. It's interesting because she goes on to describe her work as a manager and how important, how much of an emphasis she has placed for her employees on them taking their work life balance seriously. But I think it's a very interesting point, right, that Brenda's making to us, that even if we want to have that value, the system is not set up in such a way as to support that. Okay, good. What else? Yes. Yeah, beautiful. Come here again. Neshama. A really, really important point, right? We talk about work-life balance. She talks about work-family balance, but actually, life can be more than just family, right? Very nice. Yeah, fat. Good. What else do we think? Yeah. All right. Go ahead.
I think that there's like, I don't know. My thoughts about this are vast, but I think that the reality is that for many decades now, it's been the norm for women to be in the workplace. And before they were regularly in the workplace, at least after they had children, there was almost always, except obviously in situations where they couldn't afford to, the wife was at home taking care of everything.
Right.
And so if women and men are both in the workplace, then there is no one at home to take care of everything,
right,
unless you can afford full-time staff, which most people can't. And so whether it's reasonable or not reasonable, it's necessary for employers to take work-life balance seriously, because otherwise, you know, people just can't exist.
Right, good, right. It's actually interesting because I see you and Brent having a harut on this, right? Right? On the one hand, the workplace is not set up to allow us to take our home life seriously. On the other hand, our home life is not set up to allow us to take our work seriously. Right? And I just think it's sort of an interesting phenomenon to notice that this is the reality. And we all sort of just continue on as if it isn't, right? The workforce continues on pretending that there's no home, and home continues on as pretending that there's no work. And we're all sort of trying to muddle through and find our way. And I think what's very important to see about this is even if it starts as a question of women, primarily because, right, women used to be the primary caregivers, She says here, I think it's very important, that it's equally detrimental to men as well, right? Men ignoring their home life is as problematic as women ignoring their work life, right? And that, I think, is a very interesting and important thing for us to think about in 2016, I think, okay? What's fascinating to me is that when we look at the Gemara, when we look at the Talmud's perspective on this question, it's a male question. It's work-life balance is a male question. Which is interesting, because usually when we talk about work-life balance today, we talk about women. Most of the time, we talk about women, okay? In the Talmud's world, we talk about men, because they're the ones who are working. And what is the work, when I refer to work-life balance in the Talmud, what am I talking about? What's their work?
Studies.
Right, learning Torah, okay? So what we're going to see now is the question of, when I have, right, my work, which is the Torah, and I have my family, which one's going to trump? Okay, which one's going to win that battle? What we're going to see together is a series of seven Talmudic stories, which is common, right? The Bible, the Babylonian Talmud, often groups stories in a series of seven. Okay, that's a common structure of the Babylonian Talmud. And we're going to see that inside, these seven stories, that deal with the question of how do I balance my work and my Torah, really, and my home life, okay? And we'll talk a little bit more when we get there. But in order, as you know, my friend, because you are a good Pardesnikim, as you know, before I can ever look at the Talmud, before I look at a piece of Talmud, I always have to look at the Mishnah that precedes it, okay? That's what we have to do. We have to understand the legal context. So on your pages, if you'll turn the page, at the top of the page is a Mishnah from Tractate Ketubot, okay? When I talk about Tractate Ketubot,
What is tractic to vote about?
Marriage.
Marriage, yes, right? What is a ketubah?
Marriage.
A marriage contract. Yeah, that's a good, right? It is a document which outlines the obligation of a husband to his wife. Okay, that is a ketubah. And tractic to vote deals with the obligations within a marriage. In that conversation, I have a conversation about the biblical obligation for a man to have relations with his wife. Yes, my friend, it is a biblical obligation, okay? And this Mishnah is going to outline how many times that has to happen in order to fulfill your biblical obligation. That's the legal context that we are talking in. Okay, everybody with me? I'm gonna read it from the top. Mishnah. If a man forbade himself by vow to have relations with his wife, Beit Shammai ruled 2 weeks until he must divorce her. Beit Hillel ruled 1 week. Okay? We'll leave that on the side for a second. Students may go away to study the Torah without the permission of their wives for a period of 30 days. Okay? Hey, honey, I want to go to yeshiva. She says, nope, I'd like you to stay home. He says, see ya. That's what just happened. Okay? See you later. See you in a month. Bye, honey. That's what just happened, okay? Without her permission. Why do I have to say without her permission? Why would I expect him to ask for permission? Because
he's obligated
to fed it. Very nice, right? Because he is obligated to have sex with her, okay? And so, right, the question is, how frequent is that? So we're learning here, students of Torah, once a month, okay? Right? Laborers for 1 week, okay? Workers, they can leave for 1 week without her permission. Then we're told, the times for conjugal duty prescribed in the Torah are for those who live at home every day, for laborers outside the city twice a week, for donkey drivers once a week, for camel drivers once in 30 days, for sailors once every 6 months, gives meaning to a woman in every port. Right? Doesn't come from nowhere, my friends, okay? These are the rulings of Rabbi Eliezer, okay? What are we learning here from this Mishnah? Tell me what you learned from this Mishnah. How do you understand what's happening here? Yeah.
Of your work has an impact on your obligations at home.
Yes, right? The nature, Ava says to us, the nature of your work, right, has an impact on your obligations at home, okay? And if you have a job that keeps you away from home, right, the Mishnah is saying that is
okay.
That's okay. That's right. That's acceptable. That's reasonable, right? Why do you think that is? Why do you think the Mishnah says that? Why? I have a biblical obligation. Who cares if I'm a sailor or a donkey driver? What's the difference, right? Maybe I should say, you have to live at home. You can't be a sailor. Yes, Beth. Very nice, right? Yehudit says to us, very importantly, that there's another biblical obligation at play here, which is the biblical obligation to support your wife financially so that she can eat. Okay? And so what's interesting and what's important for us to see is that when I have the conversation about work-life balance or work-home balance, I actually have a balance of biblical obligations. Everybody with me? It's not just which will make me feel better and how am I going to be a good husband. That's not the question. The question is, how am I going to feed my wife or how often do I have to sleep with my wife? That's what the mission is dealing with. What's also important to understand, my friends, is there's an assumption in this Mishnah that the wife knew her husband. You only know this because the Gemara tells you this. But the wife knows whether she's marrying a donkey driver or a sailor. She knows. So in other words, what's also kind of important in this conversation is, what are the expectations that we have set within the relationship? Right? There's nothing objective here necessarily. This is a subjective conversation. And I think that's very interesting because we're trying to legislate relationships. Think about what that means, right? What does it mean that the rabbis are like, here's how often you have to have sex? I mean, think about what that means in terms of legislating what goes on in a bedroom, right? It's an interesting and it's a problematic question. It's a question, it's an age-old question, right? For all legal systems. How much do we, the law, want to get involved in what happens in the home? Right? And different legal systems make different choices about that. But I think it's interesting to notice that off the bat, Chazal, the rabbi and the Mishnah here, are interested in saying, on the one hand, I'm setting an objective standard, and on the other hand, I'm saying it's actually subjective. okay? And that, I think, is really, really interesting, and it's going to be important for us as we see the stories. Questions until now. Everyone okay? Yes. Just tell me your name.
Yaakov. So if you're a doctor or you're a shahed, so you can be, like, right in the city, and I have to go, but maybe your profession will take you very far. So how does one determine based on the profession like that?
Right. So I think the question is, do you live at home? That's what that's what the Mishnah recognizes. The Mishnah recognizes whether you live at home or whether you're outside the city, right? It's true. How do we translate this into today? As far as I know, no one is legislating this at this point in Jewish history. Is legislating this. Having said that, there are sugiyot. We're going to see in a second, right? Actual conversations that happen about that question. Okay? Good. Effect. Yes, Abba.
We did very quickly.
That was on purpose. Yeah.
There were two buzzwords that were kind of playing at each other. One was equality, and the other one was balance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure both of them are mathematical, but as you mentioned, the Mishnah is the first book of the Gemara or the Talmud, and I'm looking at the Tanakh, specifically the Torah, five books of Moses, as being the precursor to the Mishnah. So already we have an imbalance in the very first chapter of Genesis, where the woman and the man are not equal, and there's not a balance either. And then we get to the second book of the five books, and Exodus says, listen, guy, it's all in your lap or wherever, that you have to be the one that determines the nature of the home. Most of it falls on you. You better try and go and take care of the female that you hang out with, because
Absolutely right. Very important. My father is pointing out here, right, that I mentioned that we're talking here about biblical obligations. Where does that come from, right? Absolutely, we're told about Sheirah Ketuvah, and that's what this Mishnah is relying on, right? This idea that you are obligated to your wife in three things, right? To feed her, to clothe her, and to sleep with her, right? So it already is a biblical obligation. Genesis 1, we'll leave for later conversations. You guys, we can talk about that after. It's 8:45. My father wants to talk about Genesis 1. We'll have that conversation. Okay, but it's a great question. Tzarich Iyun Gadol, right? The question of equality is sort of massive. But I think it's a very important point, right, that we have already in the Torah these obligations. Okay, so the Mishnah here is telling us about the objective versus subjective nature. Okay. What we're going to do now, my friend, is what you actually came for. I know, chavruta. Okay? And we're going to do chavruta for 15 minutes. 15 minutes of chavruta. Only four stories in 15 minutes. I know you can do it. Okay, guys? Thank you so much. We're going to do story 1, 4, 6, and 7. Okay, my friend? Stories 1, 4, 6, and 7. You'll notice that there is question at the end, okay? We're going to look at this arc of seven stories, and the main question you're asking yourself is, stay with me for one more second. The main question that you're asking yourselves is, what are the rabbis telling me here about the balance between work and life, okay? And their family, okay? So you're going to turn to the person next to you. You're going to read story 1. What did I say? 1, 4, 6, and 7. You have 15 minutes. I'm here if you need me. Let's go for it.
Okay, folks. We're going to come back together, please. I know. It's very hard to stop chavrutaing. It's true. It's a hard thing. We should never really stop doing chavruta. So don't consider this stopping chavruta. We're just going to be one giant chavruta, which I like to call an infinituta. We're an infinite number of chavruta partners right now. Just giant chavruta. Okay, so don't worry. Chavruta's not over.
Okay, my friend. So at the top of your page here, right, this is the Gemara. This is a piece of the Gemara Talmud that is on this mission. And I want you guys to notice here. Rav Anna bar Ava said, in the name of Rav, this, i.e. the Mishnah, is the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer. However, the sages say that a student may leave his wife for 2 or even 3 years without her permission. Okay? Those people who are in my morning Gemara class,
What is the Gemara doing here to this Mishnah? Yeah, this is specific. My Gemara. You're here. I know you know. What is it doing? Yeah. Yes, excellent. They are qualifying, right? Here, the Gemara is qualifying my Mishnah. The Mishnah says, how long can you leave your wife for if you're going to learn Torah without her permission? 30 days. The Gemara comes along and says, oh no, you can leave for up to 3 years. That's a big difference. 30 days and 3 years. Okay, my friends? And it's interesting because it's basically saying, you see how it says Divrei Rabbi Eliezer at the end of my Mishnah? These are the rulings of Rabbi Eliezer. The Gemara says, and you should know that that is a minority opinion. And there's a majority opinion which says 2 to 3 years you can leave your wife for. Then look what happens next. Rava says, you know what happened, my friends? The rabbis relied on Adabar Ahava's qualification of the Mishnah. And they lost their lives. Da, da, da. Okay? Rava comes along and says to us, it's true that maybe it was a minority opinion, but those rabbis who relied on the majority opinion, what happened to them? What? The wives killed them. Literally or figuratively, it wasn't good news. Right, excellent, right? It seems the Gemara is not really interested in the figurative here, though. It seems that the Gemara thinks that what happened, literally, they paid the ultimate price for doing this, okay? It's a pretty harsh punishment, okay? Death is a pretty harsh punishment. Yes? Correct. Not the ones who made the good question, excellent question. Not the ones who made the ruling, right? Because that seems to be Rav Adabar Ahava. But those who followed the ruling of Rav Adabar Ahava lost their lives. And Rav doesn't just say this, my friends. But then the Gemara does what? Gives an example. Okay, it wasn't just a stomp warning. Sometimes that happens in the Gemara. Oh, this isn't a good thing. It's not a good practice. Or, lo no agin kach, we don't behave that way. The Gemara says, guess what? It actually happened. And here I go, okay? Kiha, that means I'm going to prove it to you. Thus, right? Kiha. Kiha de Rav Rachume, my friends. It actually happened with the story of Rav Rachume, who was commonly at the school of Rava at Machoza. That is an important detail, my friends. Why does the Gemara tell me that Rav Rachume was at the house of Rava in Machoza? Why is that an important detail?
Maybe it gives you more details so you can check up on the
story. Okay, good. Good point. And Rava is the one who said that they died. So when Rava says this, Avdei Uvda b'Nafshayhu, that they lost their lives, he's talking about his own students. I think that's critically important to understand. That the Gemara begins with this story, and if we had another 6 hours, we would go through every single one of these stories very carefully, okay? But you would notice that actually, really story number one shouldn't be story number one. Because it happens much later in Jewish history, and really story number two, which is kind of it should have been earlier, da 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 da, okay? But there's a reason why the Gemara chooses to open with Rav Rachume, because Rava is the one who said, FYI, when my student, Rav Rachume, followed this ruling of Rav Adabar Ahava, he actually died. Okay, and here we go. Here's the story that we're told. Rav Rachume was commonly at the school of Rav Chozah. He used to return home on the eve of Yom Kippur. He would come home, how often? Once a year. When?
Yom Kippur.
Why is that important?
There should be
yes, very important point. Because you actually do not have, that it is forbidden to have relations with your wife on Yom Kippur. Okay? So what is the story telling me? What a crazy idea. The story opens with this rabbi, who was going home, presumably to be with his wife, chose the day when he can't be with his wife.
Also, she would have to forgive him.
Yeah, she wouldn't kill him because of their giver. So she would have to forgive him. Beautiful point, Yako. Very nice. Okay. So what does this mean? Why does the story tell me this? Tell me about it. He wasn't sensitive. Good. What else? Yeah, David.
Is it more than just conjugal relations then?
Exactly. Say another sentence, David.
There's kind of an emotional commitment as well.
Beautiful. Right?
even though we are talking about the legal obligation of having relations with your wife that is listed, as my father pointed out, in the Bible, and now we're actually giving you detail on how that has to be practiced, right? The first story about this, the Gemara chooses to tell us, is actually at a time that has nothing to do with relations. It's not the point. David points out to us that I'm actually using relations to talk about something much deeper, which is a relationship. Excellent. Very nice, right? It's really about their relationship. When I say you have to go home every 30 days to see your wife, or after 30 days, I should say, right? What I'm saying there is I actually care about your relationship with your wife. I'm trying to legislate your relations. I'm trying to encourage you to have a relationship. And I think it's interesting, guys, because what's happening here in this piece is that it's a day when he's not going to sleep with her anyway, okay? And look what happens. His baby's going to be in shul all day. That is a great question, whether they were in shul all day or whether they're dominating at home. If you're interested, we're talking about it in the morning. But if anyone wants to come to our last question of the synagogue and its place in their lives, so it's a great question. But what's interesting here, my friends, is Yom Echad, okay, so in other words, on the day he's supposed to go home, Erev Yom Kippur, Mashach Te Shmata, that language is incredibly important. What does Mashach mean?
Oh.
To pull, right? It also is a language of attraction, right? Mashachti. Mashach Te Shmata. His learning, Shmata is learning, that's what I hear because I'm in an oral tradition, right? In an oral culture. Mashach Te Shmata. His learning does what? Okay, very interesting. His learning effectively seduces him. His learning seduces him and pulls him in away from his wife. Okay? His wife, this is so sad, right? His wife is looking out for him. And she's saying, Hashtaati, how you can hear it. The beautiful, like, the beautiful scene, right? Hashtaati, coming any second my husband is coming home now. Any second, right? And what happens? Lo after. He doesn't come home. Okay? Her mind becomes weak, she becomes sad, and a tear falls from her eye, right? You can imagine the split screen of this, right? You can see her face, his eye, and his teardrop falling down, and he is sitting on the roof, right? And what happens? Right? As her teardrop falls, the roof collapses under him. And he, the Nachnash, he dies. A pretty intense story that this Gemara chooses to tell me, right? What is the Gemara pointing out? Yes?
Is this day Erev
of the fourth that she's crying? I think so, right? She's saying, he's coming, and he's saying, Hashtag, because this is when he normally comes home, right? What are we learning here? What is this Gemara telling you? What is it teaching? Yeah?
Everything has a balance.
Absolutely right.
Learning Torah doesn't mean that you don't ever think about family or wife.
Good, absolutely right. There's a balance that's out of whack here. What are we upset about in this world? What?
So you set expectations for your wife, and you put that expectation.
Beautiful, right? Very important point here, right? You can see Hashta'ati means, this is what I know. I know my husband has gone 300, right, and 64 days a year, okay? That's what I know. But one day a year he comes home to me. I sit and he comes. And that expectation, right, was not met by him. The Gemara here is not bothered by the fact that they're not going to have relations. That's not the issue. The issue is that she was saying, he's coming, he's hashtag, right? And her tear. Her tear is what bothers the Gemara, okay? I think what's interesting to notice here, my friends, is that the Gemara is deeply disturbed by her pain. Right? It's not just about the legal obligations. In fact, I would argue, it's not even about legal obligations at all. That's not the point here. The point is, you set an expectation, and you cause another person pain. And that was enough, right, to cause you to die, okay? Pretty terrible, right? In terms of work-life balance, what are we saying wins here? Life, correct. You messed up, Rav Rahume, right? You were supposed to be much more focused on your life, you were too focused on your work, okay? I want you to notice, though, from the very beginning here, we are setting up the Torah as
Yeah, but absolutely right. We have a lot of din v'cheshbon, right? We have a din v'cheshbon. How much time is that? Justice being done here. But what is the Torah in this scenario, my friends? Yeah. Beautiful. Absolutely right. Beautiful. Excellent point, right? Rivka said to us, right, that there's something in his behavior here that is selfish, and the Torah is being used for self, right? As opposed, there's an abuse in a way of the Torah here by him, right? Very, very nice. Think about what this. Yeah, yeah, yes. Sure.
If there's going to be a miracle, why is the miracle not taking the game
for what? Oh, such a great question. Why aren't we having him zooped over there, right? It's a great question. Beautiful, right? It's a great question. So, Rechiyun, I think that the Gemara here is interested in saying to me, yeah, also, you want to say something? Do you want to respond to that? Do you want to respond to that, though? Okay. Does anyone want to respond to that? Yeah, David?
Because I don't think it's about him physically being there.
Good.
It's about him wanting to be there.
Oh, very nice. Right? It breaks down the relationship. There's a bit of breakdown here. And what is the breakdown, my friends? He chooses the Torah. Yes, very, very important point here, right? This is certainly Daniel Boyarin's read of this text, Professor Daniel Boyarin from the University of California, Berkeley, right? His read of this is the Torah is being set up here as the other woman. Now, you might think I'm exaggerating, except that you all read story number 7. And story number 7 seems to say it explicitly, right? Who is the other woman in this relationship? Okay? Is the other woman my wife? No, don't go there. Don't go there. Stay with me. Okay. Is the other woman my wife, or is the other woman the Torah? It's being set up here right away. And what we're learning here is, on Erev Yom Kippur, you allowed yourself to be pulled in by this mistress and ignored your obligations to your wife. Okay? So that's a pretty harsh move. Yeah, I'll go ahead.
I just wanted to say, the way setting up here, like work-life balance, but I think Torah here is much more than work. It's
good.
Another passion, and it's something that the rabbis value very highly.
Beautiful.
It's not just like, oh, I need
promotion
in order to get money to feed my wife.
Right. Beautiful.
It's something I'm dedicated to.
Beautiful. Excellent. Very, very important point, right? It's not just about, right, work. Right? It's something I'm passionate about, something that I'm consumed by, I think it's really important. And I want to add, right, it's very, very important, I want to also add another point here, which is, it's also a deoraita, biblical obligation to learn Torah. I want us to understand that actually it's not just wife versus wife, but it's biblical obligation of learning Torah, the obligation to learn Torah, right, and biblical obligation of being with my wife. So I want us to, I have two passions and I have two obligations. It's not simply, right, that I got distracted. That's not what we're talking about here. It's actually, I feel physically torn. I don't know which one I should be focusing on, okay? I so want to take your hands. I'm going to actually go on just because we have three more stories to get to, okay? And we only have 25 more minutes, okay? So, keep in mind, okay, if we can get to it in a bit, we will, okay? So that's story number one. We have more time, we can do stories 2 and 3, but we're going to move on to story number 4, okay? And in the Babylonian Talmud's structure, what's important to notice here is, again, if we have more time, we'll prove it, but there's actually a chiastic structure happening here, okay? Which means, right, chiastic structure is 1, 2, 3 matches up with 5, 6, 7, and the main point of what I'm trying to say in the middle of my X, right, X marks the spot, in the middle of my X is story number 4. So story number 4 is really the main point of what I'm trying to say. Look what happened, my gosh, if we thought story number 1 was heartbreaking, it was devastating, but story number 4, I would argue, is even worse. What happened? Listen to this, my friends, right? Rabbi Chanina ben Chachinai set out for the home of his rabbi at the end of the wedding of Shimon bar Yochai, okay? So, Chaim Bar Chachinai wants to go learn. And he's at Shimon Bar Yochai's wedding. Okay? Everybody with me? Which is important. Because Shimon Bar Yochai says to him, listen, just hold up. Just wait till the end of the week. And I'll go with you. But what happens? He cannot wait. I have got to get back to the Israel. I gotta go. And Shimon, just give me 2 days. No, I gotta go now. Okay? His desperation here is so interesting. I must go to learn Torah. Okay? Bar Yochai did not wait. He went. And he sat learning at the home of his rabbi for 12 years. I want you to notice we've jumped from once a year to 12 years. That's going to be important because when we get to Rabbi Akiva, it's going to be 24 years, right? Twice 12, okay? So 12 years, a huge jump, right? And, right, he doesn't wait, he goes to 6 or 12 years. By the time he left, i.e. to come home, listen to this sentence, later. All the roads of the city had changed, which I understand what that feels like. When I was just in New York 8 weeks ago, okay? But there's something about this feeling of, right, and it's true in Yerushalayim. It is a true phenomenon, right? Again, 12 years from now, I don't know what the city is going to look like, right? It's going to be beautiful, hopefully, right? Thank God. But, you know, it's such an interesting idea. What's the message there? Everybody forgot him. Good.
A lot of time
passed. Life goes on without you. You can never go home again. Right? There's really a message here. Literally, I cannot find my way home. Right? Think about how much must have had to change. The hyperbole is quite strong here, I would argue, right? You can never go home again. So what did he do? He went and sat by the river. Why? That probably stayed the same, right? Oh, that's possible now with today's technology. Who knows? It probably stayed the same. What else?
That's where people went to walk.
That's where people went, right? Perhaps someone's going to know me. I'll go sit there. Someone will know me. Good, right? What else? There's a metaphor, I think, happening here, which is water as Torah, right? Oh, I don't know anything, but I know Torah. I'm going to go sit there. I'm going to sit by the water, right? I'm going to go sit by the water, and lo and behold, look what happened. He heard a young girl calling out, Bat chachinai, fill up your jug, and let's go home. Okay, stop dawdling, fill up your jug and let's go, okay? He hears her being referred to as Bat Chachinai, and says, oh, that must be my daughter. I know, because he's also Bar Chachinai, it should be his sister, but it actually is really his daughter, okay? What we know is because she goes into the house and his wife is there, right? So it's actually his daughter, which, again, if we had more time, we would notice that a huge motif in these stories is the father-in-law. The father-in-law has a huge role. In fact, it seems like his daughter gets adopted, if you will, by his father, right? Because he's not there. And we're going to see it with Rabbi Akiva. We're going to see it again with Rabbi Yosef. It's interesting to notice that the father-in-law has a very critical role here. So when he says, oh, Bar Chachinai, oh, that must be mine. That must be my kid. Which means, my friends, he did not recognize his daughter. So he couldn't get home. He doesn't know his kid. I mean, it's true, the story of falling through a roof is painful. But this, it's so harsh. Imagine, I can't get to my house. I don't know who my kid is, right? It's so painful. He follows her home. Oh, his wife was sitting and sifting flour. Also important, my friends, I have water, Torah, and I have flour. Ain't kemach, ain't there no flour, no Torah. Lo and behold, she is in charge of the kemach. It's not for nothing, right? The Talmud, no details for nothing, right? So it's interesting to notice that she's stuck, but she is in charge of making sure that their family is fed, which is supposed to be his obligation. He knows the water. She has the flour, right? It's interesting, okay? And what happens? She lifts up her eyes, sees him, her heart swells, and she dies. I mean, look at this story. Cannot wait to get to the Nebuchadnezzar. Literally cannot wait for his friend. Gets there. There for 12 years. Apparently isn't right home at all. Doesn't say I'm coming home. Doesn't let her know. Right? Doesn't know how to get home. Doesn't know his kid. And doesn't sustain his family. And kills his wife. No, really. It's one thing when he dies, okay? The other thing when he kills her. That's what just happened. I mean, this is the ultimate, the worst you could get. This is as bad as it gets, I would say. Right? Literally as bad as it gets. I have destroyed everything around me. Okay? I just wanted to notice that. And this is the main point of these stories. What are the rabbis telling me here?
Balance.
Good. Okay, back to balance. Good. What else?
Again, aim.
Yeah, it's interesting, though. It's interesting because this is not actually in the sugya, in the section that deals with feeding your wife, right? It doesn't seem like she's lacking for food, right? Some are maybe but sending money home. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe they're wealthy. I mean, it's an interesting question, right, about the flower.
It's not only about money.
You're fair.
Because, yes, they can have money, but if there's no relationship down to the point that he doesn't even bother to tell his wife, and he doesn't even probably have a picture of his child in his mind all this time that he's away,
right.
So much that, so that he is actually at her,
right.
Then, of course, what worse can we do?
Right. This is literally as bad as it gets. Yeah, Gary, go ahead.
Could this be a cautionary tale to the students in these yeshivas and saying, like, you think that you have her permission or you don't have her permission, but you're there and you're learning and you can't pull yourself away, but you may never be able to get
her. Beautiful. I absolutely think that it's a cautionary tale. Right. Let me tell you how bad it could get. It could get terrible. It could be the worst possible. Absolutely. There's a cautionary. And the cautionary tale, though, is at the center. And what it's not just, I tell you a cautionary tale, and then I tell you the best story ever. Right? Actually, the cautionary tale gets the center stage, right? I say that because it's number four, right? Which is in the middle of my arc of stories. Number four, it's the one I'm going to remember. It's the one I want you to think about. It's the one I want you to know. This is the message, right? Yeah, you came to learn Torah. That's great. But you know what you did? You neglected your family. Completely. And you're never going to be able to go home again. Lucas.
It's also a parenthood. If the previous one is about relationship with the wife, this is relationship with the daughter.
Beautiful.
He was not a father. And when, is this her reward? Is like, is this what she's getting for being a good mother? The daughter is still alive. So it's like, I was a horrible father, but she was a great mother, and she's still alive.
Right.
So.
And look at this language. Very, very important. We didn't finish the story. It's great. Excellent, right? He turns to God. Ribono shel Olam, ani yazu zeschara. This poor woman. This is her merit, and look what happened. Oh, it's okay. Ba'arachmeyala, right? It's okay. A miracle happens, and she lives. Another miracle. The first miracle we saw was to kill him, right, presumably. The second miracle we see is to bring her back to life, right? So presumably, there's a message here that's okay. It's okay, even as it's a cautionary tale, God's going to take care of it. It's all okay, right? But there still is a deep message of, you're going to destroy your life if you're not careful, okay? If you let yourself be pulled in, you're going to destroy your life, okay? I'm so sorry, guys. I only have 10 more minutes. We have to go on. I really want to take your hands up. We're going to go on now. Because story number six seems to be where it all turns around. Well, the truth is, story number five, Daria, your point about a cautionary tale, I want you to notice, story number five, just for 1 second, good, he says, Rabbi Chanan bar Beis went and sat for 12 years in the Beit Midrash. When he returned, he said, oh, I'm not going to do what the son of Hachinai did. So it seems that they all knew. Right? It literally was cautionary tale that they knew. I mean, he's like, oh, I'm going to write my wife a letter and tell her I'm here. I'm not going to, like, kill her. I'm not an idiot. I said, it's so not only is it a cautionary, it seems that they were literally telling the story. It's an amazing idea. It's like they actually are saying, listen, this is what happened to that guy. Don't be like that guy. Right? Literally, he says, I'm not going to be like that guy. Okay, so story number six. Such an interesting moment, my friend. This is a very, very famous moment. Very, very famous story in the Talmud, which I think doesn't get learned in its literary context. So now you know, right, what the context is. Several stories of how terrible it is when you neglect your wife. In that context, I tell you the greatest fairy tale of all time. The story of Akiva and his wife. Really, it's the greatest fairy tale. Listen to what happened. Rabbi Akiva was a shepherd of Ben Kalba Sagua. The latter's daughter, seeing how modest and notorious he was, said to him, want to marry me? Like, come on. It's literally, you know, this is being recorded, I can't really say this. That's what we're talking about here. Literally, the richest man in Jewish history, guys. That's what we're talking about here. That's who Kalba Sagua is. Kalba Sagua is, Ben Kalba Sagua was, Tisha B'Av is coming up, so we're going to read this story, I'm sure, a lot. But he is said to be one of the people who kept Jerusalem fed during the siege. Okay, he's one of the wealthy men who kept Jerusalem fed, right? Before the Babylonians burned down the stockhouses. But in any event, that's the only other place we see him is that he was able to keep Jerusalem fed. That's how wealthy he is, okay? And Rabbi Akiva was his shepherd. Can you imagine the daughter of the richest man in the country walks up to you, a shepherd, and says, hey, want to marry me and go learn? Definitely has a fairy tale quality, I would say, right? I love this moment. Look what happens, guys. What does he say? Yeah. The only word we hear from him for 20 lines of the month. There's nothing else to say besides, yeah. whatever you want, I'll do whatever you want. And it's actually really fascinating, I love to point this out, because the Aramaic here is really important, because she says to the men in the room, please do not say this, but she says to him, "E mikadshan alach, were I to be betrothed to you," which the classic language under a chuppah today, the traditional language is, "Hare at mikudesh at li," that's what the man says. You'll notice that there's an inverse here, where she says to him, "E mikadshan alach, if I were to be betrothed to you." She is pursuing him. Okay? I think this is very clear, right? She is pursuing this relationship. She walks up to him. She sees how, what does she notice about him? How what? How tzniyus he is, right? How modest he is, right? Who do we normally call tzniyus? When modest, right? It's interesting to notice that she is pursuing him. She notices his humility, right? How humble he is, how tzniyus he is, how modest he is. It's very interesting just to notice the power dynamics involved in this relationship, but she presumably picks him out of the crowd and betroths herself to him in secret. Because why in secret? Presumably because if her father finds out, then what? There goes all the fortune, and lo and behold, her father finds out, and there goes all the fortune. Right? And he swears, right? He makes a nether, an oath, that she will not ever benefit from him. It's so important to know, when I say, it's not just that I cut her out of the will. Right? When I say that my daughter will never benefit from me again, it means she can't even walk across my yard. Like, it is completely cut off. Okay? So that's what's interesting to me. Okay? Teresa, I can't bring any benefit from his estate. And Rabbi Akiva goes and spends 12 years at the academy. When he returns home, he brings with him 12,000 disciples. What does it tell me, my friends, that he brings home with him 12,000 disciples? What does it tell me about this guy?
He has no idea how
his wife's favorite was. He did not send her a warning. Please make sure you have food and beds for 12,000 people. To this point. What does it mean about him?
He's done really well.
He's got what?
Leadership qualities.
Absolutely right. What? Somebody said 1,000? A year, which is really interesting because presumably not in the first year because he's nobody, he doesn't know anything. Not in the second year because he's, you know, maybe he's in sheer debt, you know, what does he know? Right? But probably not until the sixth or seventh year did he start amassing students, okay? So I would say 2,000 a year probably. Towards the end of his tenure there, he's starting to have students who want to learn. 12,000 disciples, right? Tell me about this guy. Leadership is good, but tons of charisma. You have to have tons of charisma, like 12,000 students, okay? It also means that you don't... How was your relationship with those students?
It's not close.
Yeah, you don't know them very well. You really can't maintain a close relationship with 12,000 students, let alone what's coming, which is 24,000 students, right? So 12,000 students, he comes into camp. His wife hasn't finished cooking yet, presumably, right? And he hears an old man saying to her, "How long will you lead the life of a living widow?" What is that? What is the old man saying to her? You're married, but it's as if
you're a widow.
Because your husband is gone, right? You're an abandoned wife, okay?
Isn't she more in a
state? Yeah, it's a great point. We never actually see Nisuin here. We never actually see them marry. But presumably since later on they have a daughter, and the parallel version to the story, we actually do see them marry and live together before he goes off. So it's a great question. It's a great point. All we see here is Kiddushin. It's a good point, at least technically. It's a good question on this piece. But I would argue that probably they didn't marry, okay, because they're children. So, but good point, okay? Yeah. Yeah, it's such a great question. Why couldn't we just go with our husband? Fantastic question. Did not seem to be the practice. There's another conversation. I'm going to sidebar for a second, and you guys are going to allow me 7 more minutes to go over, yes?
Yes?
8:52?
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay, so sidebar for one quick second. There's another sugya in Kiddushin wherein it seems that they ask the question, how can you learn Torah when you have a wife? She will just be, right, a chain around your neck. So I care for my wife because then she's going to want to hang out, go to the movies, and it's hard. To take care of it, right? So I have to be immersed, right? I'm looking for an immersive experience in a baby dress. Like, please. Right. But I think that's the point, right? I won't be able to focus, right? My wife is at home, I'm here learning, I'll go home and see her, okay? I think also it has to do with the father-in-law and, like, who's taking care of the family. She needs support, I think. So taking her with him That does not seem to be an option. It's a great question. It's an age-old question. So, right? She responds, well, if he would listen to me, he would sit another 12 years. I want you guys to notice this because I think this gets skipped over. He says, oh, it is then with what? Her
consent.
Remember the Mishnah told me, right? Without her consent, he can leave for 2 to 3 years, right? If I read the majority opinion. Now what he's saying is, oh, I have her reshoot for permission for another 12 years because she said so. I'm good.
Why didn't you just go in and say
hello? Yeah, why? This kills me every time. Just go say hello. Well, you can't say for 24 hours. Hi, honey, I'm home. I brought some guests. I don't know. What? I don't know. Yeah. Now, this is one of those moments where we have no idea whether he went or didn't go in or if the conversation went like this or didn't go like this. But the story is not concerned with that. The story is interested in telling me that what he is concerned with is
her consent.
Now, I want to ask you, what tone do you think he says this? She says this to the old man in?
Proud.
Proud. Good. What else?
Loving.
Loving. Okay. Yeah.
Angry.
Offended. I also think so. I think that there's a little bit of defensiveness. He's angry or offended at. There's a defensiveness here. Oh, please. I am fine. We have got it handled. I got carpool arranged. Right. I have babysitters. We're fine. I'm working full time. Everything's fine. I have the food in the fridge. We're good. Right. It's not necessarily true that she is saying to him, they had a long conversation, they worked it out, they discussed, you know, how they're going to work on it, and she says, okay, honey, I give you permission. That's not what happened here. He overhears a comment, which very likely could have been her saying, shush, like, it's none of your business what me and my husband decided we're going to do, right, about our life together, okay? And her, it's a very interesting question. And I think you can read it in two ways. The story can be read in hundreds of ways, like any piece of the Talmud, but I think it's interesting to notice, right, either it's possible that she's like, I'm fine, I really am fine, I really have a handle, and everything is fine. I knew that this was going to be our arrangement, and I'm fine with it. I know who Akiva is, I picked him out of the crowd for a reason, I saw who he was, and I sent him off, right? I actually made this man who he was, right? That's one way of reading the story, I think. And then another version, which is, I say go learn. I didn't say go for 24 years, right? And what's interesting is to notice that the society around them also is disturbed by it. Which I think is really interesting. There's two moments here where we hear outside voices who are also disturbed by Akiva's behavior, both from the old man, and then look what happens next. So he says, oh, it's with her consent, I'm acting, and he goes away for another 12 years. When he finally returns home, right, he comes home with 24,000 students. His wife hears he's coming this time. When they came back with 12,000 students, nobody knew. It was a big secret. But this time she hears, which is just so interesting. That's an interesting idea that the Gemara expects us to understand that. I think the idea is right. He's only at the midpoint of his career potential. When he comes in with 24,000 students, it's like this town hero is coming back to town. And, right, he comes to town with 24,000 students. Here, again, 1,000 per year, or perhaps, right, 2,000 per year until, like, the next six years, right? His wife hears she's coming, and she goes out to greet him. Her neighbors say to her, that's what you're wearing? Exactly. I love that the Talmud discusses that. I think it's so awesome. That's a really old thing of women commenting on each other's clothing. It's an interesting phenomenon, right? The Gemara's noticing it, picking up on it. And what does she say, my friends? What does she say back to her neighbors? Oh my gosh, your dad Sadiq, you next wish for him too. Right? Oh, yeah, good. There was a little bit of cringing there. Yeah, I think we should cringe a little bit. It's on purpose, right? What is she saying here, my friends? Yeah? He put me in this position. I think, again, if you're reading this in the fairy tale voice, she's saying, we're above that. Lipstick, makeup, clothes. What are you talking about? We know each other's soul, okay? Akiva knows who I am, and I know who Akiva is, right? And I want you to notice, guys, what did we say his profession was? He was a
shepherd,
right? Not for nothing that she says, I am his behemoth, right? I am his animal, which is disturbing. I understand disturbing this. The disturbing nature of that. But on the other hand, there's something here about, I think she's also saying, I knew him when he was a shepherd. He's a tzaddik now, but I knew him when he was a shepherd. And he knew who I was. Right? We know each other in a way that is deep and way beyond what you guys understand. I think it's one possible read.
I think there's another read here, right? Which is, look at this power dynamic. It's so unbelievable, right? She was this powerful, strong, wealthy woman who pursues him. He was his little shepherd. At a certain point in the narrative, there was a potential for them to be equals, which is when he comes home, in the midpoint, right? But instead of him talking to her, relating to her, he overhears, makes a decision without talking to her about it, setting expectations, right? Not setting expectations there. And as the story goes on, we see her decline to the point where she describes herself as a behemoth, right? And he comes back to town with 24,000 students. And that's not all, my friends. What happens next? She comes out to greet him and she falls at his feet, and his students come to
push
her away. That's so heartbreaking. Not as heartbreaking as not being able to find her way home, I think. But imagine what that means if I am a Rosh Yeshiva, the head of an institution, the head of a yeshiva, and my students see a poor better woman, and how do they treat her? What does that mean about the Torah that they have learned from Akiva? It's such a critique. It sounds like the greatest story of all time. This wealthy woman picks me out of a lineup, makes me Rabbi Akiva. We have this deep, close relationship. My father-in-law shows up, this is the ultimate fantasy, and gives me half of his wealth. I mean, come on. Are you kidding me? Can you imagine? You've been neglecting my daughter for 24 years. Here's half of my money, right? I mean, that's what happens in this story. The ultimate rabbinic fantasy. And yet, what we're hearing is these moments of pain. I think it's an interesting phenomenon to see this story, which is, the story goes further, I think, and it's an even deeper critique of Akiva, in that what happens to these 24,000 students, friends, elsewhere in the Talmud? They all die. And I think there's a very interesting comment here on when I allow myself to have the Torah take over my life such to the point that I ignore my wife for all of this time, when I let Torah be prime over my family, right? The Torah that I create is not sustainable. It will not live on because I cannot separate Torah and respect. And we see that his students do not learn that lesson of respect, right? So it's interesting to notice, right, which is, you were pointing out before, that it was between him and his wife. The first story is between him and his wife. The fourth story, between him and his family, children, right? And now we're learning, there's also an element of you and your students, right? There's a student problem here as well. Your students are not going to learn the kind of Torah that you want to teach. And how does it get resolved, my friends? The seventh story is fascinating because the seventh story takes me back to story number one, right? Why? Who are we back with here? Rava. Notice that? Story number seven. Rav Yosef, the son of Rava. We're back to Rava, guys, right? Which is who we started with. Was sent by his father to the academy under Rav Yosef. Different Rav Yosef. Rava, you with me? There's Rava and Rav Yosef, who are Havrita partners. Rava's son's his kid, Rav Yosef, right? Sends his son, Rav Yosef, to the school of Rav Yosef. Different guys. Everyone with me? Yeah. You with me? Okay. Right? To stay there for 6 years. He maybe learned his lesson. Not 24, not 12, maybe just 6. Even though he was the guy who said to me that what? Going for 3 will get you killed. It's a question, when does this story happen, right? It sounds like maybe before Rav Yosef, maybe, right? But look what happens here. They arrange him to stay there for 6 years. Having been there 3 years, it was Erev Yom Kippur, and he said, I want to go and see my family. Who does that come from? For the first time, we're seeing that the husband wants to go home. Right? Yeah. Definitely married in the store. Okay? That's what it means that they gave him 6 years. They would only give him 6 years. It was part of the ketubah arrangement with the wife. When it says they gave him 6 years? Yeah, it means that they arranged, mean that was the agreement they came together on the ketubah. Okay. So he's like, oh my God, it's Erev Yom Kippur. I haven't seen my family in 3 years. I want to come home. First time we're hearing that from the husband. He wants to come home. Right? Presumably they had a good marriage. I think that's what we're seeing here, right? I want to come home, okay? When his father hears that he wants to come home to his wife, what happens? He goes out to meet him with a knife, a sword. Okay? Crazy man. Come on, this is a crazy story, right? He said, oh, so not technically skirt. Oh, now you remember your prostitute? Who's the prostitute?
His wife.
Woo! That's his head, right? I have 2 more minutes. I like this little intense story for the 2 more minutes, right? But what does it mean? What does it mean that I call my your wife your prostitute? What does that mean? Who's my actual wife?
Torah.
That's what I was saying. Oh, then the Gemara says to me, no, don't worry. Ika ta'amre, there are those who say, yesh omrim, there are those who tell the story differently. He didn't say, zonatech, God forbid. No, he doesn't call his wife his zonah, his prostitute. No, that's terrible. Yonatech miskart. Oh, now you remember your wife? After 3 years? You should have come home 2 years ago. Oh my gosh. You see the difference? This is why the Gemara is so awesome. Look at how awesome this Gemara is. I can read it in both ways. Either I read this as, Rav is saying to his son, what are you doing home after 3 years? You should have come home only after 6 years. Right? The first read. And now in that read, his wife is the prostitute. Right? And the Torah is his wife. In the other read, Ika d'amrei read, he says to him, oh, now you remember your wife after 3 years? You should have come home after year one. What are you doing here now? You're not tech, right? And it's very interesting, by the way, because we're talking about literally a little bit of ink. A zayin and a yud are not far away from each other. Zonatech, yonatech. That's what we're talking about here. 2 different letters, same word, just a little more ink. So you could understand, by the way, why, presumably, there are different versions of this story, right? Either because of writing or even because of phonetically, right? Yonatech, zonatech. They're close. They're close words. And one means your wife is the other woman, and one means your wife is your partner, right? This idea that doesn't come with it. Is it actually true? Maybe it's true in the real world. It's certainly true in the Gemara world, right? That does make for life, right? So when I call her, you're not. What I'm saying is, this is your wife. What are you doing with this other woman called the Torah? And you know what happens? Look at this, right? Ichrud, right? They fight, and neither one ate the meal before the fast. They go into Yom Kippur without having eaten, right? Mar lo ifsik, the lo mar ifsik, right? They did. This one didn't eat before the fast, and this one didn't. The ultimate sin in Judaism is not eating, right? That's how we end the Torah. And they both been hungry. I love that. That's the end. You see what the tragedy was? They didn't eat before Yom Kippur. Terrible. But the Gemara, my friends, and this is I'm going to end. But the Gemara here leaves us with a story of 2 alternate versions. Is my work my mistress, or is my work my life? Is the Torah my mistress or my wife? Is my wife my mistress or my true partner? And you know what? Do I have a solution at the end of this Gemara? No. Marlo Ipsik? It's been Marlo Ipsik. We all go hungry. And I think it's a fascinating move. The Gemara does not resolve the problem, my friends. It didn't resolve it in 200 or 400 or 2016. It's a massive question. But there is a serious warning here, which is, it is very easy to have the Torah supplant your life because it's something I care about and I'm dedicated to, and it's the center of our entire existence. Everything about our world, especially in their world, is about the Torah. It is very easy to lose sight of your family. And even in the best case scenario, where my wife picks me out of a lineup of shepherds and wants me, and my father-in-law gives me all his money, even there, I'm saying that there is a grave price to pay when I allow Torah to overcome my treatment of another human being. Then my Torah is not true and will not last. But the struggle is real, my friends. And it existed in the Talmud, and it exists today. So we're living in the struggle. With that, I'm gonna end, and I'm happy to talk more and go on. Thank you guys so much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.